You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, I'm Tom Wally. I'm with Lizzie Banks. Lizzie, why do I have to get the RSPCA involved? Why are you pouring water on cats?
Well, Tom, I thought the question that we were supposed to ask at the top of this podcast was, where are we, Tom? And I should be asking that question to you because your accent is changing. Where are you, Tom?
No, yeah, you have noticed. Obviously, since moving back to Nottingham, my once dormant Nottingham accent is starting to... It's been resurrected. So, yeah, it is coming back with some force. Particularly
in
these sort of episodes.
It's erupting like an Icelandic volcano.
Yeah, particularly in these episodes where I'm, you know, speaking to a lot of Notts folk, it's coming back heavy. But it's one of those things that it just lies dormant, waiting to be brought back to life. But Lizzie, you're in, you know, talking of moving places and accents, how's your French?
Très mal. Not very good. Well, where am I, Tom? I have just moved house. I'm now in France, just on the edge of the Jura, between the Jura and Geneva, but on the French side. And it's lovely here. It's absolutely boiling hot. Had to pour water on my cats to keep them cool. Having to pour water on myself to keep myself cool. But it's lovely here. Lovely to be here. And just need to learn a little bit of French because at the moment it's not very good.
But before we move on to sort of the main thrust of this episode, I just want to say congratulations. Well, first of all, I want to say congratulations on being a woman because of the Tour de France. But more than that, no, congratulations on the whole event, but also congratulations on the way you, Rose and Rook covered it, because it was... I produced three or four of the episodes and I thought the coverage was fantastic.
Just the coverage in the one you produced, Tom, or...?
Well, I mean, I produced more than half of them, but, you know, the coverage in general, I just thought you guys were fantastic. I mean, Lizzie, I was going to ask you, because obviously, you know, not being able to ride it, you know, I would have found it hard to enjoy it, but your enjoyment of that event really came through.
Well, firstly, thanks, Tom. Yeah, I mean, it was a brilliant event, and it was so great to be a part of the coverage, especially as I wasn't able to be there on the ground and still not actually able to ride my bike at the moment, which is, not great, obviously. But I mean, the biggest shout out has to go to Rose, who was on the ground. You know, she was the only... Well, Anna-Marie Rook was also on the ground, but, you know, it was just Rose and her partner Phil and her young baby Tamsin collecting all of the interviews. And she did such a phenomenal job every single day. She absolutely killed the interviews. And it's, you know, such an important part of having that coverage and having that feel that you're there, you know, with the riders every day. But it was a really great thing to be a part of. I'm really pleased that I was able to kind of contribute to... Well, this amazing momentum that we have in not just in women's cycling and women's sport. Of course, on the final day of the Tour de France Femme, we also in the UK had the Lionesses winning the final of the European Championships in football to such a phenomenal amount of support. There was a record crowd at Wembley for a Euro final. And just the response to the Tour de France Femme, you know, this isn't just because it's women's sport, it's because it's really, really good sport. And I hope that if there's anyone listening to this who hasn't listened to the Tour de France Femme coverage because you think maybe, oh, it's only women's cycling, I beg you, please go and listen to it, because that race was brilliant. It was electric. Even the stages that we thought not much would happen, there was chaos and, you know, stories from every angle, and it was absolutely brilliant. There wasn't a moment's rest, there wasn't a dull moment, and that is what's so great about women's cycling, along with the fact that every single rider has such a good story. Everybody has fought so hard to get here that their backstory is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I've got to say, some of the stories, and well, credit to you guys for bringing those stories to us. In the sort of, well, how long has it been? It's been, well, less than a week since the event ended. I guess in that time, Lizzie, you've spoken to riders, to colleagues, friends who did the event. What have they told you about it? What are their thoughts, you know, since, you know, when they've had chance to reflect?
Well, I think this is actually a really common phenomenon whenever you're inside a bike race, that you don't realise how big it is until you come out of it. When you're in the race, you're so deeply within the race. You're so focused on everything that's going on, the processes, you know, get up, eat, go to the race, race, come back, eat, sleep. And you sometimes don't even quite realise the momentum that there is outside of the race and the response that there is outside of the race. And you might have your own frustrations about performance or whatever it is. And then you get outside and you speak to people, and just riders coming back through airports. You know, my good friend Leah Thomas, who rides for Trek Segafredo, she said she was coming through Charles de Gaulle Airport, and there were four or five people who stopped her to say, "Oh my goodness, were you riding in the Tour de France list last week?" And that would never, ever have happened before. So it just shows that global reach and the kind of the enormity of the reach of the name of the Tour de France that you just wouldn't get with any other race. And that's why it's so important. And actually, I was listening to Ned Bolting's podcast, Never Strays Far, and he was talking about how he was frustrated that ITV hadn't covered the Tour de France fam, and perhaps that it was because in the first year of an event, financially, it just wasn't viable for a free-to-view broadcaster. But having seen the success, that he hopes that they will cover it next year, and I hope that there is a push from all sides, from the public, from within the organisation, to cover it, because Eurosport GCN, our colleagues over there, they did a brilliant job, but having that free-to-view coverage just increases the reach to a place beyond cycling. That's when we really find the new fans for the sport, and you have all these people that you've drawn in from the first 3 weeks, and then you say, hey, don't forget to keep watching, because tomorrow we're not going to have that black hole that usually comes with the end of the Tour de France. We're going to fill it with some more spectacular racing from the best women in the world.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And further to what Ned was saying, I think that the TV figures, particularly in France and Europe, have been, well, I was going to say really encouraging. They haven't been encouraging. They've been great.
They've been phenomenal. Yeah, I think phenomenal. They've blown any expectations completely out of the water.
Well, before we move on to the meat of this episode, which is all about the way supply chains are affecting you as a bike consumer and affecting World Tour teams and their ability to get the parts that they and the components that they need, were there any sort of tech headlines to come out of the Tour de France, fam? I mean, one thing I noticed, I mean, there was the gravel stage where there was a hell of a lot of punctures. Now, I don't know whether I'm right in comparing that to what the men did in just their Roubaix stage. Again, you know, completely different surface. But the women, the amount of punctures did make me think, is something going wrong here? Is there maybe a bit of disparity? What did you make of that?
No, I don't think so. I think if you actually go back to the men's Roubaix stage five of the Tour de France on, there were a huge amount of punctures and mechanicals, as there were in Roubaix, as there were on the gravel stage four of the Tour de France Femme. Everybody who was on the ground reported how severe that gravel was, and it was particularly the final two sectors two and one, where the gravel was so rough. It wasn't really gravel. A lot of people were just describing it as just stone sort of like thrown onto the road. And if you're going at speed, especially if you're going blind at speed into that kind of thing, you will get a puncture. You know, if you can really choose your line and see exactly where you're going and go a bit slower so you can avoid things, then you can mitigate that risk. But when you're in a bunch and you're going hell for leather and you've got, you know, 20 people in front of you, you just can't see. And whatever you do with the best equipment in the world, you know, there will still be punctures. That's just a fact of life. You know, tires are not infallible. They're small pieces of rubber and these are big bits of rock. But it was interesting to see actually how both the men's and women's DSM team shunned the automatic tire pressure system that was revealed back in, but it was just a couple of days before Roubaix actually, the Scope Atmos. And this was a system by which they could increase and decrease their tire pressures according to whether they were about to come into a cobble sector, whether they were then on a tarmac sector, whether they wanted a higher pressure and a lower rolling resistance. And it kind of was sold as a bit of game-changing technology. But then the riders decided at the last minute that they didn't want to use it. They didn't trust it. There was obviously then a few more months between then and the Tour de France. And still the riders said that they didn't want to use it. And it was cited that they didn't trust it. But as we know, riders are a fickle bunch. And if we think about tubeless, when tubeless first came, which is now, you know, pretty ubiquitous within the professional peloton, and also saves a lot of skin, I would say, because there's a lot of people who've realized at the end that they've got slow punctures, but they've got to the end without having to, you know, having to have stopped. So yeah, you know, we know now the benefits of tubeless, but the riders didn't trust it at first, and it took a long time for it to become commonplace within the professional peloton. So basically, the message is, don't trust anything a professional rider says.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That is Seb Piquet interrupting to remind me to tell you that this month's episode of Service Course is sponsored by Stitch Fix. Do you ever wish you could send someone out shopping who knows your exact size, what you do and don't like to wear, and how much you'd like to spend on each item? If I could, I'd send Lionel Burney out shopping for me, because Lionel Burney these days looks fresh. Why does he look so fresh? Because he's been using Stitch Fix. Stitch Fix is a service for both men and women, and it makes shopping for clothes easy. To get started, go to stitchfix.co.uk/cycling to set up your profile, and then they'll deliver clothes chosen just for you in your taste, size and budget. They arrive at your door a few days later, and you get to try everything on at home, decide what to keep, and then send anything else back. It's easy. You can schedule at any time, there's no subscription required, plus shipping, returns and exchanges are easy and they're free. Stitch Fix does the hard work for you, making shopping for clothes easy and free from hassle. Get started today at stitchfix.co.uk/cycling and get 20% off when you keep all five items. That's stitchfix.co.uk/cycling for 20% off when you keep all five items in your fix. stitchfix.co.uk/cycling. Lizzie, have you tried to source, you probably don't need to do this, you know, have you tried to source any of your own bike components recently?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially if you look back to 2020 when we were all at home and we weren't with teams, so we weren't able to get equipment from teams, we were all sourcing our own bits and pieces. And especially when we went back to the team, we started racing again after the first sort of lockdown in, you know, sort of August, September 2020. I remember I asked the mechanic, you know, could I have a new chain for my bike? And he said, no, I'm sorry, we simply don't have enough for the team. So I couldn't possibly give one to you because we don't have enough for the race bikes. And you simply couldn't get hold of components. I was actually building my husband a bike with, I was trying to source SRAM Red actually. And it was so difficult to find it. I managed to find everything that I needed eventually, but it was very, very difficult and took a long time, and things coming from, you know, various places, which when you looked on the internet, you wondered if they were actually ever going to arrive. And that's continued. That has continued that trend for the last 2 years. And, you know, it's been something that's affected everything. You know, the supply chains for clothing for 2020, 21, 22, they've all been delayed. For bike parts, they've all been delayed. And it's just been across the board. Every single professional team has had these issues. Every single, I think, just amateur rider has had these issues getting what they need. And I don't think there's a single person within, you know, who rides a bike who hasn't been affected in some way, whether they just want a new tire, a new tube or a new chain, whatever it is.
Well, I have to give a shout out to, what's the name of the group on Facebook, Lizzie? You recalled it much better than I did.
Cycling Podcast General Chat Group, I think.
Yeah, that's the one on Facebook. So I actually popped in there and I spend quite a bit of time in there, but I asked our listeners whether they'd tried to buy a new bike recently. And some of the answers, I'm just going to read you a few of the answers before we move on to the next, well, my sort of deep dive into the supply chain issues. Adam Sim said, I purchased one, but I won't get it for another 6 months, which is, you know, very, very unusual when it comes to bikes. Richard Hamilton said he bought one that was due in May 2023, 3, but that did arrive 2 weeks ago, so he got his early. Barney DeBerry said he bought a Trek Domain ETAP, and his nearest dealer told him that there would be an 18-month wait. He did actually find one in an independent shop. And Paul Rowland said he spent months last year trying to get on a waiting list for a Cannondale Super 6. He told he would have to wait a long time, but he actually managed to, again, doing a desperate Google search, he managed to find one where there was some stock. But again, it's a lot of people just doing some research and finding where there's stock. I wanted to know a bit more about the ways in which the pandemic and the supply chain crisis are continuing to affect cycling. So I went on the Tour de Supply Chain.
Okay, so I'm going to start this month's podcast with the corniest line that I'm going to use throughout it. Here we go. When you buy a new bike, normally you think about chain sets rather than supply chains. There you go, there's the line. I'm stood outside the White Horse, which, for those of you who listened to my episode about the social history of rally cycles, you'll remember that. It's the green tile-fronted pub that features heavily in Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. It's used in the film. And it's the sort of start of my journey today. I'm basically going back through the last 2 years and telling the story of bike shops, bike sales, basically the experience of bicycle retail throughout the pandemic. Now, we might be exiting the pandemic, or at the very least for most of us, we're sort of living with it. But I don't know if you've bought or tried to buy a new bike recently or get parts for your bike. The impact of the pandemic is still being felt. And I want to demonstrate that in this month's episode. I'm going to go and visit a few bike shops, find out how they've been getting on. But our journey starts just up the road from here. Right then, take a little walk with me. This is where we start. So I'm just walking into the Victoria Centre now, past the Chopsticks noodle bar. And I was here a few weeks ago, and there's a very shiny bike showroom here, one of Britain's, I guess, biggest bike brands. I'm not going to name them, but you know, it doesn't take too much to work out who they are. But I was in that store the other day, and it's one of those stores that's pretty minimal. Just a few high-end bikes in there, got one of each model. What I noticed is that every bike had pretty much the same group set on. And it's not the latest group set. It's not Dura-Ace, and it's certainly not Dura-Ace from this year. So I got chatting to them in the shop, and what I understand is that basically a lot of the group sets just haven't come through yet. There are supply chain issues. So if you're buying a new bike this year, chances are you've not been able to get the latest components or the components that you expected to come with your bike. And anecdotally, this is not just affecting the consumer, it's affecting teams at the top level of the sport, and it's affecting other sports too. So in this podcast today, I'm going to attempt to understand why that is and dig a little bit deeper into the supply chain crisis and figure out and try and find out if and when it's going to ease, or is this, as everything else seems to be classified as, the new normal. So I set off on my tour de supply chain around Nottingham, but not before stopping off to get my ear pierced, because obviously I'm 40 and I'm clearly having a midlife crisis.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Cool. So just keep your head level and face forward.
All right, back to the bikes.
My name's Matt Nequest and I own Bunny's Bikes.
I started by asking Matt what it was like running a bike shop back in 2019.
Bikes were just got really scarce, and you'd sell all your old stock that you've had for years and years. We heard rumours of other bike shops that have had bikes 5-10 years, and they got rid of them all to customers, and because customers didn't mind what year a bike they were buying in previous years, it always had to be the newest, latest model. And that ethos has changed now as we're going forward.
So Jamie Ireland, I own Cycle Inn in Beeston. Beeston's premier shop, been here nearly 100 years, so yeah, still going strong. So.
Well, listen, you just got back from Denmark.
Yeah, exciting trip.
So. Yeah, but you did miss Jonas Vingegaard's presentation.
I did, literally one day, and the hotel was directly facing the balcony that he came out on in the county hall, so a bit gutted, but there you go. So.
Did you not even get any of the fly past or any of that?
Yeah, we got the fly past when we was on the beach at the other end of Denmark, 400k away, but yeah, so we're still kind.
Well, I didn't come to ask you about Denmark. It's just last time I was here, you spoke brilliantly about bike shops over the course of the pandemic. So yeah. I'm going to quickly take you back to 2020, March 2020. I think you actually shut, didn't you, originally? Or you didn't shut, but you furloughed.
Yeah, furloughed both members of staff, came in on my own, walked down the high road to work, absolutely nobody around. Thought, what's going to go on? I've got the business and self-employed. I've got kids at the university. And then within a week, I was probably as busy as I've ever been in 30 years in the trade. It continued pretty much the whole year, really. Then the problem became the year after, the second year of lockdown, the problem then became nobody had any bikes.
When did you... So the supply chain crisis, as we know it, you probably saw that coming a lot sooner than everyone else, I guess.
Certainly. I used to be involved in shipping from bike factories in China and Taiwan. So, yeah, I know the delays, and the guy that now does my job, I'm still in contact with. So I was well aware of the shipping delays that were coming and the lack of containers and the costs and and it's still not recovered yet.
And what about, so as a customer now, so if I've, you know, I've got my dream new bike build and I'm coming in, so I'm flicking through the catalogues with you and I'm saying, I want this, this, this and this on it. What sort of looks on your face?
It's normally a case of, Ron said, yeah, no problem. It's a case of getting the laptop out and checking stock at different distributors, because normally it would be a given that you'd get the bits. Now it's not, which I'm having the same problem with SRAM components, Shimano components for people that have got bike builds or big trips planned and they want big jobs doing. You've got to make sure the bits are there before you book them in or before you promise anything. So
I think last time I was here, you were telling me that you didn't even know when new bikes for this year were coming in.
It's still pretty much the same now. The 2022 range of bikes, certainly from Merida, which I ordered February last year, not this year, they're only just starting to come through now. We've got bikes on the water, I've got bikes in stock, but we're having to order years worth of bikes in advance, so you can't just get the catalogue out and go, there's that. You've basically got to order as many bikes as you can physically store, be it here, parents' houses, garages, lockups, and fill them up with bikes, because no wholesalers have got stock of bikes on the floor. So
last question, is there anything in particular, any particular component that is like hen's teeth at the moment?
There is. I do hear this from a lot of shops, but knowing this was going to happen midway through first year of lockdown, I just continued buying. I've probably got more stock now than a lot of the big stores. I counted up the other day and I've got nearly 4.5 grand worth of bottom brackets, where normally I would normally carry not even, you know, if I would say a grand's worth, it is pretty much, that's probably being over-exaggerated at that as well. So, yeah, no, I'm not doing too bad. Yeah, not doing too bad.
Well, the Tour de Supply Chain isn't an epic bike ride, because my next stop was barely half a mile away, also in Beeston.
My name's Rodney Rouse, and the shop is the Bike Lounge in Beeston, Nottingham.
Now, whereas the Cycle Inn boasts a framed Chris Froome jersey on the wall, the Bike Lounge celebrates a much more local rider. There's a Lotto Soudal jersey that used to belong to James Shaw up on the wall in that one. So I've heard anecdotally from mechanics from a couple of World Tour teams that parts are now being reused, people are on older versions, older iterations than what they might have expected to be. Is that the sort of thing you're hearing as well?
Well, just looking at it on the telly, really, you can see that, you know, at the start of the year, people are on, you know, previous generation chain sets or previous generation wheels, whereas now you look at the later races, sort of post-tour, and everyone's on this year's kit, you know, and it's all matching group sets as opposed to odds and sods.
Well, listen, you've got a very different experience to a few of the other bike shops I've been speaking to, because a lot of them are 100 years old or more. You actually opened during the pandemic. So tell us about that. Tell us about when you opened tell us about the shop when it opened.
Yeah, so we were basically, it's something I've wanted to do for a long time, trying to find the right premises at the right price at the right time. That was about February 2020, just as sort of COVID was sort of hitting Far East, that sort of area. Not really dreaming that it was ever going to come to Europe, and if it did, come to the UK. So it was kind of, do we, don't we? We kind of waited a bit. We probably waited a bit too soon to see what was going to happen. And then when we finally bit the bullet and decided actually there was never going to be a better time to open, letting agents, solicitors and everyone else had all closed down because of the pandemic. So it delayed everything and put everything back a few months. But it was all hands to the pumps and get it all painted, fitted out with what we could and from who we could. We had bare walls, we had plaster missing because you couldn't get plaster or plasterboard. We had roof tiles missing. We got open around about June, I think it was, end of June. And we actually had the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, came over and officially opened the shop back end of June. And sort of never looked back since, really.
So, I mean, opening in, obviously, you know, a lot of bike shops I've been speaking to, their experiences, you know, by June, you know, that they'll ride in that wave, that boom of cycling. You were opening right into it. So what was it like opening that sort of time?
Well, thankfully, with me working in the trade sort of past 40-odd years, I'd got a lot of contacts, and I think what you found was a lot of suppliers had stock, but they were being quite selective on where they were sending the stock and trying to eliminate some of your big internet chains and people like that, basically just coming in and clearing the stock out. So because at the time we were sort of new and just ordering in dribs and drabs, we were very fortunate that we could get stock when we wanted it and pretty much what we wanted. I mean, obviously there was some issues, but we quickly built up a stock of the essentials and then built from there, really.
And then when did you sort of get an inkling that, okay, we've weathered one crisis and there's now there's the supply chain crisis coming? I guess you probably saw it before us regular folk, because obviously, you know, you're ordering stock months in advance.
Yeah, well, previous to opening the shop, I was working for a distributor. Sort of right in the early days, certain products we were already seeing prior to me even opening the shop. So I kind of knew what we were letting ourselves in for and what we needed to plan for and make sure we were sort of prepared for. And then, yeah, like you say, you see it at distributor level, then you see it at retail level, then you see it at customer level. And it's not, even, you know, I'd still say it's not fully back where it should be and where it needs to be, but it's definitely getting that way. Sort of daily basis is improving, get most of it.
And is there anything that's, you know, particularly tricky at the moment? I mean, one of the things I was looking at, I went on one of the big online retailers earlier on, and I noticed that they had, in terms of Shimano group sets, top end ones, there was nothing on sale at the moment. I went in a top end bike shop, I looked at all their range, all had Altegra on. I mean, is sort of Shimano, is that one of the worst affected, or is there other parts?
I think they're all probably as bad as each other. I think actually Shimano is probably one of the best. Right. I think SRAM's probably the worst, closely followed by Campag in terms of availability and supply chain. And then Shimano have probably ended up coming the best out of it. And they've probably done the best out of it as well, of all of them. Because you look at some of the suppliers, you know, the thing is 80%, plus probably was Shimano in terms of OE supply. So for them to ramp it up, you know, it's a bit easier than these people who were doing 20% of the market to get 300-500% demand increase. So Shimano have come out of it all right, I think. Like we said before, that some of the Pro Tour bikes are now getting full group sets, whereas before they were reusing part group sets and bits like that. So it's obviously a sign that it is improving. And I think if you come in and you want a nice bike of any variety, whether it be a mountain bike, a road bike, you know, whatever, we can generally find you something at your budget. The issue is when you get some people who come in and they want it, you know, pink with yellow spots or something, and it's got to be certain sizes, certain dimensions, that's when you get the issues. But in terms of finding something to suit your riding and your budget, we can generally do it.
The first rule of recording on location is, well, always keep your tape running. Another rule is always make sure that your recorder has got batteries in. I managed to do neither of those two things. I had a follow-up question for Rodney, but luckily I had my phone with me and was able to switch to that.
Yeah, you know, it's so big. We haven't even spoken about Brexit and red tape and stuff and getting stuff into this country. But you're saying that actually getting stuff into this country is, again, sort of adding to the crisis.
Yeah, I think it's certainly adding more hurdles. And like we were just saying, a couple of brands that I know, they're finding it much easier to distribute into other territories as opposed to the UK. So if they've got 100 sets of wheels and they know there's a customer somewhere else wanting 100 pairs of wheels or something, they'll send them there as opposed to the UK, because it's just so much easier and quicker for them. Less hassle. They know the pricing, they know the taxes, they know their import duties. Nothing's changed, so they'll just send them there. If they get some left, then the UK might get some and might benefit from a few sets of wheels or whatever it is. But certainly if there's demand elsewhere around the world, it'll go there first.
When I returned from my tour to supply chain, I wanted to take a deeper look at what was going on with supply chains around the world. So I spoke to Professor Richard Wilding, OBE, who is a supply chain expert. And I began by asking him if and when there's going to be an end to this crisis.
Well, yes, it will. It will ease. But part of the problem is that we're still getting disruptions. So even if we're going and thinking about, you know, the bicycle or bicycle component supply chains, we're still getting lockdowns occurring around the world. We have to remember that, you know, everybody's partying in Europe at the moment. You know, we're not seeing that, but we still have lockdowns actually taking place in Asia. You know, so China has various areas where they're locking down still. And as soon as that starts to happen, that then has a knock-on effect globally. And we're still seeing that. One of the things that we've got a wonderful term, but we have something called the bullwhip effect, which occurs in supply chains. And we've seen this very recently. So what happens is effectively demand for a product will just disappear. So, you know, when we think about what was happening in 2020, a lot of the demand for many products just disappeared. A lot of the requirements for people just disappeared. So we had all the furlough schemes. We had people then looking at their lives, changing jobs, changing roles and everything else. So all the lorry drivers went, actually, I found another job. And to be quite honest, I prefer it. So I'm going to do this. You know, and we have, you know, people in retail and restaurants, similar sort of situation. So everything just sort of went away. It was like the tide went out. And then all of a sudden in 2021, we then ended up the tsunami wave of demand coming in on us. And that's been the big challenge, because everybody wants everything and they want it now. And supply chains just aren't designed for that. And also, due to the pandemic, everything is in the wrong place. You know, so we talk about this well-choreographed ballet. We have containers which are moving from east to west. They need to get through the ports. Once they're in, they will then be taken back to their original locations. It's a bit like, you know, at a supermarket. You want the trolleys near the entrance to the supermarket. You don't want them in the extremities of the car park. You know, you need a process to get them all there again. And effectively, that has broken down within the supply chain.
You've looked a little bit into the cycling industry and where things are made. And is it obvious to you, just from that little bit of sort of surface research, why and where the problems are arising?
But for mass, you know, the mass production of cycles and things, what you're starting to see is very quickly, it's like most things, a lot of the manufacturing is taking place in Asia, you know, and you could say, you know, China's probably the biggest manufacturer. And as we've been saying, you know, part of the challenge with that is then we've had the rolling lockdowns. We've had, you know, getting containerization, because you've got to sort of think about costs of being able to move things as well. And this is really important. So, you know, the price of moving containers have sort of gone up tenfold. Because of the shortages of containers. Now, you have to sort of think that, you know, if you're suddenly paying, I mean, a good example is slightly different to bikes, but you'll get the picture here. If we're moving, say, sofas, and we're manufacturing them in China, generally in one of those big containers you see, you get about 50 in one of those. Yeah, so 50 sofas into a container. Now, if all of a sudden, it's costing you $20,000 to move it from Asia, you've got to take that, you know, $20,000, and you've got to divide it by 50. That increases the cost quite substantially, you know, just to be able to get it and move it and so on and so forth. So, however, if you've got smaller components, you can get an awful lot in a container. Okay, so one of the things that we often talk about is this amazing concept of cube, you know, which is, you know, actually the size of the product. And then we talk about value density as well. So if you've got very, very expensive items, you know, I don't know, if we're moving diamonds or something like that, you're not going to put them on a boat. You're going to literally fly them because their value per the size of it is really, really expensive. So if you think about some bike components, they may have they're incredibly expensive, super high value components. It's probably, you know, they're saying, well, hang on a minute, I'm making some quite big margins on these. I'm going to fly them. So, you know, well, more interesting things is, you know, if you're thinking about ladies' lingerie, Victoria's Secret, stuff like that, often it's air freighted because, you know, if you think about a pair of knickers, you can pack that down into a tiny little, you know, bundle, and it's worth quite a bit of money in comparison. So you can get an awful lot into a container, which we can load onto a plane and we can move it relatively quickly. But we don't have that, you know. If you're looking at bikes, you know, how many bikes can we get into a container? If the price is super high, that's going to create issues for us, because that's going to increase the cost. But also, you've then got to get that container. Yes, you can pay the money for the container, but you've then got to get it through, and you've got to get it onto a boat to actually get it moving. So all these things can then just start disrupting the supply chain and having a big impact on the availability of the components that you actually need. So that's, if you like, just on that movement side. But also then you have to think about the raw material side. So if you're looking at, you know, specialist things like, for example, say bike frames, and you're looking at, say, titanium, or you're looking at, you know, specialist alloys and so on and so forth. Guess which countries are the ones which you could say are the big producers of those raw materials? Typically, it's going to be Russia, China, Australia. You know, those are generally the big ones for most of the types of alloy that we're using. And of course, that all those are being significantly disrupted at the moment. OK, so, you know, carbon fibre, key resource, which is being used on bikes at the moment. But when you actually look at that, there's a big shortage as well of, of carbon fibre. And the market really is mainly aerospace. That's where the money is. OK. And you've then got what they call industrial, and bike stuff is within that industrial umbrella. But what the carbon fiber manufacturers are doing, of course, is what they're wanting to do is actually do the high-end aerospace stuff, because that's where the money is.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
I just want to pause here to say thank you to Science in Sport for all of their sponsorship for the Cycling Podcast over the last few years, but particularly over the last month or so. It's their support that allows us to cover events like the Tour de France and be there producing daily episodes. And their support also helped us to produce daily episodes from the Tour de France firm. Thank you to Science in Sport for keeping the cycling podcast on the road all around France for, well, just over 4 weeks. If you need any Science in Sport products, and of course you do, then you can get 25% off your next order when you go to scienceinsport.com. Just enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Lizzie, we heard there about, and I can see why a lot of the teams aren't really willing to talk about this sort of stuff, because it can sound critical of their sponsors and the people who supply their components. But we are hearing and we are seeing that even the World Tour teams, both men's and women's, are struggling or are facing supply chain issues. You know, they're having to reuse parts and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that it reflects badly on any, you know, sponsors, manufacturers, because it's not anybody's fault. It's part of a global issue. And as you referenced in the package, you know, of course there was first the pandemic, then there was the Russian war with Ukraine, and on top of that, in the UK, of course, we've got Brexit, which just makes things even worse. So if you want to source something from Europe, it's very difficult now. And yes, teams have had this across the board. And actually, I would say that men's teams have probably been affected worse than women's teams, because they have more bikes to be able to kit out. And so if you only need, okay, so let's say women's average women's team has 12 to 14 riders. If you need 12 sets of a type of component, you're probably much more likely to get that than if you need 33 sets, but that's just for the first race bike, right? And so then you need that amount for the spare bike. And then, you know, men's teams might have 3 or 4 bikes for one rider. So then that's going up to, you know, 150, 200 of one component. So the volumes in the men's side are so much higher than the volumes in the women's side that I think that they are even more likely to be affected. And we saw that in the spring. It was pretty rife, actually. There were a number of men's teams who were running 11-speed Shimano, this in particular with Shimano, 11-speed Shimano chain rings with 12-speed group sets, and were having quite a lot of very obvious problems with chains dropping. Probably the most famous being Casper Asgreen at the top of the Koppenberg in the Tour of Flanders, when he was in defence of his title there, of course. And, you know, some say that he lost it due to that. Some say that, you know, he was just out-cycled. But it's very common, and I don't think that, you know, I don't think talking about it should or does reflect badly on particular sponsors, because it's simply not their fault. It's just the way the world is right now.
Well, listen, I think you should all be very grateful to me, because I do all my cycling on the turbo or on my fixed gear, so I'm not using up any of this precious supply of components at the moment. So, yeah, my lifestyle choice is benefiting all of you, so that's great. Lizzie, before we move on, is there any other business, anything you wanted to mention before we shoot off?
Well, actually, just to say that just the news about Shimano 105 going DI2, and I think
you can get that, by the way. That is one of the ones you can
get. Is that the only thing that you can get? But what you can't get now is new Shimano 105 mechanical. So the news that Shimano 105 is being upgraded to DI2 comes with a sort of bittersweet tinge.
Well, it's the end of the mechanical era, isn't it?
Yes, I'm kind of split about my thoughts on this, because I think it's great that the trickle-down effect is coming to 105 and it'll be cheaper and easier. But having said that, it's £1,700, €1,800, $1,900. And that's still a lot of money. It's not an accessible amount of money, really, is it? Let's be honest. And I think that the demise of 105 mechanical is quite sad, because it was pretty good. You know, it was pretty good at a pretty entry-level price. And it's a shame not to be able to get that. And I guess, you know, I wonder what it will be replaced with. And I hope that what it will be replaced with won't be worse and more expensive than what we had before.
Well, listen, I've never had an electronic group set on any of my bikes. I mean, I've used them. I've never had one. So I think next time, it feels like the next time I get a bike, I won't be able to avoid it. So
yeah. Yeah.
I'll have to upgrade.
It was only last year that I finally got DI2. And I have to say, it's probably made the biggest difference of any single thing. The shifting is very, very good, but it is very expensive. And, you know, if you need to repair it, it's very expensive as well. And if you need to repair it, if you travel away somewhere, it can be very, very difficult. So I still very much advocate mechanical shifting.
Well, I'm just going to Google how supply chains are affecting batteries. That's the that's going to be the next issue, isn't it, I guess, if everything's got a battery in it. Well, Lizzie, listen, I'll let you go. I'll let you enjoy the glorious sunshine on the France-Switzerland border. We didn't even talk about the Large Hadron Collider either.
No, but it's a good thing because I don't really know anything about it. And that at dinner last night, I was having a conversation about nuclear fusion. And when it got to the part that there was helium magma suspended in a tube being suspended by magnets, and the reason that it couldn't burn through the vacuum is because it was being suspended by magnets. At that point, I kind of... yeah, realised I was pretty out of my depth about what was going on. So it's probably best that we don't continue to talk about it, because I have absolutely no idea about how any of it works.
Well, listen, Lizzie, now you know how I feel. all right, well, listen, I'm gonna let you go, and I'll catch you again in about a month's time.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
I should probably say thanks.
I'm going to keep saying that. I love that.